From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. Number 90 by B. M. Croker. For a period extending over some years, a notice appeared periodically in various daily papers. It read, "To let furnished for a term of years, at a very low rental, a large, old-fashioned family residence, comprising 11 bedrooms, 4 reception rooms, dressing rooms, 2 staircases, complete servants' offices, ample accommodation for a gentleman's establishment, including 6-stall stable, coach house, etc. This advertisement referred to number 90. Occasionally you start running for a week or fortnight at a stretch, as if it were resolved to force itself into consideration by sheer persistency. Sometimes for months I looked for it in vain. Other folk might possibly fancy that the effort of the house agent had been crowned at last with success, that it was let, and no longer in the market. I knew better. I knew that it would never, never find a tenant. I knew that it was passed on as a hopeless case, from house agent to house agent. I knew that it would never be occupied, save by rats, and, more than this, I knew the reason why. I will not say in what square, street, or road number 90 may be found, nor will I divulge to human being its precise and exact locality, but this I'm prepared to state, that it is positively in existence, is in Charleston, and is still empty. 20 years ago, this very Christmas, I was down from New York visiting my friend John Holyoke, a civil engineer from Charleston. We were guests at a little dinner party in the neighborhood of the South Battery. Conversation became very brisk as the champagne circulated, and many topics were started, discussed, and dismissed. We talked on an extraordinary variety of subjects. I distinctly recollect a long argument on mushrooms. Mushrooms, murders, racing, cholera. From cholera we came to sudden death, from sudden death to churchyards, and from churchyards was naturally but a step to ghosts. John Holyoke, who was the most vehement, the most incredulous, the most jocular, and the most derisive of the anti-ghost faction, brought matters to a climax by declaring that nothing would give him greater pleasure than to pass a night in a haunted house, and the worse its character, the better he would be pleased. His challenge was instantly taken up by our somewhat ruffled host, who warmly assured him that his wishes could be easily satisfied, and that he would be accommodated with a night's lodging in a haunted house within 24 hours, in fact, and a house of such a desperate reputation that even the adjoining mansion stood vacant. He then proceeded to give a brief outline of the history of number 90. It had once been the residence of a well-known county family, but what evil events had happened therein tradition did not relate. On the death of the last owner, a diabolical-looking aged person, much resembling the typical wizard, it had passed into the hands of a kinsman, resident abroad, who had no wish to return to Charleston, and who desired his agents to let it, if they could. A most significant condition. Year by year went by, and still his highly desirable family mansion could find no tenant, although the rent was reduced, and reduced, and again reduced to almost zero. The most ghastly whispers were afloat, the most terrible experiences were actually proclaimed on the housetops. No tenant would remain, even gratis. And for the last 10 years, this handsome, desirable town family residence had been the abode of rats by day and something else by night, so said the neighbors. Of course, it was the very thing for John. He snatched up the gauntlet on the spot. He scoffed at its evil repute and solemnly promised to rehabilitate its character within a week. I was charged by our host to serve as a witness, to verify that John Holyoake did indeed spend the night at number 90. The next night, at 10 o'clock, I found myself standing with John on the steps of the notorious abode. But I was not going to remain. The carriage that brought us was to take me back to my respectable chambers. This ill-fated house was large, solemn-looking, and gloomy. A heavy portico frowned down on neighboring barefaced hall doors. The elderly caretaker was prudently awaiting us outside with a key, which said key he turned in the lock and admitted us into a great echoing hall, black as night, saying as he did so, "My missus has made the bed and stoked up a good fire in the first front, sir. Your things is all laid out, and I hope you'll have a comfortable night, sir." "No, sir, thank you, sir. Excuse me, I'll not come in. Good night." And with a word still on his lips, he clattered down the steps with most indecent haste and vanished. "And of course you will not come in either," said John. "It is not in the bond, and I prefer to face them alone." And he laughed contemptuously. A laugh that had a curious echo, it struck me at the time. A laugh strangely repeated with an unpleasant, mocking emphasis. "Call for me, alive or dead, at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning," he added, pushing me forcibly out into the porch, and closing the door with a heavy, reverberating clang that sounded halfway down the street. I did call for him the next morning, he desired, with a caretaker who stared at John's commonplace, self-possessed appearance with an expression of respectful astonishment. "So it was all humbug, of course," I said as he took my arm, and we set off for our club. "You shall have the whole story whenever we have had something to eat," he replied somewhat impatiently. "It will keep till after breakfast. I'm famishing." I remarked that he looked unusually grave as we chatted over our broiled fish and omelette, and that occasionally his attention seemed wandering, to say the least. The moment he had brought out his cigar case and lit up, he turned to me and said, "I see you are just quivering to know my experience, and I won't keep you in suspense any longer. In 4 words, I have seen them." I merely looked at him with widely parted mouth and staring into questioning eyes. I believe I had the best endeavor to give the narrative without comment, and in John Holyoake's own way. This is as well as I can recollect his experience word for word. I proceeded upstairs, after I had shut you out, lighting my way by a match, and found the front room easily, as the door was ajar, and it was lit up by a roaring and most cheerful-looking fire, and 2 wax candles. It was a comfortable apartment, furnished with old-fashioned chairs and tables, and the traditional 4-poster bed. There were numerous doors which proved to be cupboards, and when I had executed a rigorous search in each of these closets, and locked them, and investigated the bed above and beneath, sounded the walls, and bolted the door, I sat down before the fire, lit a cigar, opened a book, and felt that I was going to be master of the situation, and most thoroughly and comfortably at home. My novel proved absorbing. I read on greedily, chapter after chapter, and so interested was I, and amused, for it was a lively book, that I positively lost sight of my whereabouts, and fancied myself reading in my own chamber. There was not a sound. The coals dropping from the grate occasionally broke the silence, till a neighboring church clock slowly boomed 12. "The hour," I said to myself with a laugh, as I gave the fire a rousing poke and commenced a new chapter. But ere I had read 3 pages, I had occasion to pause and listen. What was that distinct sound now coming nearer and nearer? Rats, of course, said common sense. It was just the house for vermin. Then a longish silence. Again a stir, sounds approaching, as if apparently caused by many feet passing down the corridor. High-heeled shoes. The sweeping switch of silken trains. Of course it was all imagination. I assured myself, or rats. Rats were capable of making such curious, improbable noises. Then another silence. No sound but cinders and the ticking of my watch, which I had laid upon the table. I resumed my book, rather ashamed and a little indignant with myself for having neglected it, and calmly dismissed my late interruption as rats, nothing but rats. I had been reading and smoking for some time in a placid and highly incredulous frame of mind, when I was somewhat rudely startled by a loud single knock at my room door. I took no notice of it, but merely laid down my novel and sat tight. Another knock, more imperious this time. After a moment's mental deliberation, I rose, armed myself with a poker, prepared to brain any number of rats, and threw the door open with a violent swing that strained its very hinges, and beheld, to my amazement, a tall, powdered footman in a lace scarlet uniform, who, making a formal inclination of his head, astonished me still further by saying, "Dinner is ready." "I'm not coming," I replied, without a moment's hesitation, and thereupon I slammed the door in his face, locked it, resumed my seat, also my book. But reading was a farce. My ears were aching for the next sound. It came soon, rapid steps running up the stairs, and again a single knock. I went over to the door, and once more discovered the tall butler, who repeated, with a studied courtesy, "Dinner is ready, and the company are waiting." "I told you I was not coming. Be off and be hanged," I cried again, shutting the door violently. This time I did not make even a pretense at reading. I merely sat and waited for the next move. I had not long to sit. In 10 minutes, I heard a third loud summons. I rose, went to the door, and tore it open. There, as I expected, was the servant again, with his parrot speech. "Dinner is ready, the company are waiting, and the master says you must come." "All right, then, I'll come," I replied, wearied by reason of his inopportunity and feeling suddenly fired with a desire to see the end of the adventure. He accordingly led the way downstairs, and I followed him, noting as I went the gold buttons on his coat, also that the hall and passages were now brilliantly illuminated by glowing candles, and hung with living green the crisp leaves of holly, mistletoe, and ivy, reflecting back the light. There were several uniformed servants passing to and fro, and from the dining room there issued a buzz of tongues, loud volleys of laughter, many hilarious voices, and a clatter of knives and forks. I was not left much time for speculation, as in another second I found myself inside the door, and my escort announced me in a loud voice as "Mr. Holyoake." I could hardly credit my senses, as I looked around and saw about 2 dozen people dressed in a fashion of the 18th century, seated at the table set for sumptuous Christmas dinner, and lighted up by a blaze of wax candles and massive candelabra. A swarthy, elderly gentleman, who presided at the head of the board, rose deliberately as I entered. He was dressed in a crimson coat braided with silver. He wore a white wig, had the most piercing black eyes I ever encountered, maybe the finest bow I ever received in all my life, and with a polite wave of his hand, indicated my seat, a vacant chair between two powdered and embroidered beauties, with overflowing white shoulders and necks sparkling with diamonds. At first, I was fully convinced that the whole affair was a superbly matured practical joke. Everything looked so real, so truly flesh and blood, so complete in every detail, but I gazed around in vain for one familiar face. I saw young, old, and elderly, handsome, and the reverse. On all faces there was a similar expression, reckless, hardened defiance, and something else that made me shudder, but that I could not classify or define. Were they a secret community, burglars or counterfeiters? But no. In one rapid glance I noticed that they belonged exclusively to the upper stratum of society, bygone society. The jabber of talking had momentarily ceased, and the host, imperiously hammering the table with a knife handle, said in a singularly harsh, grating voice, "Ladies and gentlemen, permit me to give you a toast, our guest," looking straight at me with his glittering coal-black eyes. Every glass was immediately raised. 20 faces were turned toward mine when, happily, a sudden impulse seized me. I sprang to my feet and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I beg to thank you for your kind hospitality, but before I accept it, allow me to say grace." I did not wait for permission, but hurriedly repeated a Latin benediction, ere the last syllable was uttered. In an instant there was a violent crash, an uproar, a sound of running, of screams, groans, and curses, and then utter darkness. I found myself standing alone by a big mahogany table, which I could just dimly discern by the aid of a street lamp that threw its meager rays into the great empty dining room from two deep and narrow windows. I must confess that I felt my nerves a little shaken by this instantaneous change from light to darkness, from a crowd of gay and noisy companions to utter solitude and silence. I stood for a moment trying to recover my mental balance. I rubbed my eyes hard to assure myself that I was wide awake, and then I placed this very cigar case in the middle of the table as a sign and token that I had been downstairs, which cigar case I found exactly where I left it this morning, and then went and groped my way into the hall and regained my room. I met with no obstacle en route. I saw no one, but as I closed and double-locked my door, I distinctly heard a low laugh outside the keyhole, a sort of suppressed, malicious titter that made me furious. I opened the door at once. There was nothing to be seen. I waited and listened, dead silence. I then undressed and went to bed, resolved that a whole army of butlers would fail to allure me once more to that Christmas feast. I was determined not to lose my night's rest, ghost or no ghosts. Just as I was dozing off, I remember hearing the neighboring clock chime two. It was the last sound I was aware of. The house was now as silent as a vault. My fire burnt away cheerfully. I was no longer in the least degree inclined for reading, and I fell fast asleep and slept soundly till I heard the cabs and milk carts beginning their morning career. I then rose, dressed at my leisure, and found you, my good faithful friend, waiting me, rather anxiously, on the hall doorsteps. I have not done with that house yet. I'm determined to find out who these people are and where they came from. I shall sleep there again tonight, along with my bulldog, and you will see that I have news for you tomorrow morning, if I am still alive to tell the tale, he added with a laugh. In vain I would have dissuaded him. I protested, argued, and implored. I declared that rashness was not courage, that he had seen enough, that I, who had seen nothing and only listened to his experiences, was convinced that number 90 was a house to be avoided. I might just as well have talked to my umbrella. So once more I reluctantly accompanied him to his previous night's lodging. Once more I saw him swallowed up inside the gloomy, forbidding-looking, re-echoing hall. I then went home, in an unusually anxious, semi-excited, nervous state of mind. I lay wide awake, tumbling and tossing, hour after hour, a prey to the most foolish ideas. Ideas I would have laughed to scorn in daylight. More than once I was certain that I heard John Holyoake distractedly calling me, and I sat up in bed and listened intently. Of course it was fancy, for the instant I did so there was no sound. At the first gleam of winter dawn, I rose, dressed, and swallowed a cup of good strong coffee to clear my brain from the misty notions it had harbored during the night, and then I invested myself in my warmest top coat and set off for number 90. Early as it was but 7:30, I found the caretaker was before me, pacing the pavement, his face drawn with a melancholy expression. I was not disposed to wait for 8 o'clock. I was too uneasy and too impatient for further particulars of the Christmas dinner party. So I rang with all my might and knocked with all my strength. No sound within, no answer. But John was always a heavy sleeper. I was resolved to rouse him all the same, and knocked and rang and knocked, incessantly for fully 10 minutes. I then stooped down and applied my eye to the keyhole. I looked steadily into the aperture till I became accustomed to the darkness, and then it seemed to me that another eye, a very strange, fiery eye, was glaring into mine from the other side of the door. I removed my eye and applied my mouth instead and shouted with all the power of my lungs, "John! John Holyoake!" How his name echoed and re-echoed up through that dark and empty house. "He must hear that," I said to myself, as I pressed my ear closely against the lock and listened with throbbing suspense. The echo of Hollyock had hardly died away when I swear that distinctly heard a low, sniggering, mocking laugh that was my only answer, that and a vast, unresponsive silence. I was now quite desperate. I shook the door frantically with all my strength. I broke the bell. In short, my behavior was such that it excited the curiosity of a police officer who crossed the road to know what was up. "I want to get in," I panted, breathless with my exertion. "You'd better stay where you are," said the police officer. "The outside of this house is the best of it. There are terrible stories." "But there's a gentleman inside it," I interrupted impatiently. "He slept there last night, and I can't wake him. He has the key."
"Oh, you can't wake him," returned the police officer gravely.
"Then we must get a locksmith." But already the thoughtful caretaker had procured one, and already considerable and curious crowd surrounded the steps. After 5 minutes of maddening delay, the great, heavy door was opened and swung slowly back, and I instantly rushed in, followed less frantically by the police officer and the caretaker. I had not far to seek John Hollyoak. He and his dog were lying at the foot of the stairs, both stone dead. My Own True Ghost Story by Rudyard Kipling. As I came through the desert, thus it was. As I came through the desert, the city of dreadful night. Somewhere in England, where there are books and pictures and plays and shop windows to look at, and thousands of men who spend their lives in building up all four, lives a gentleman who writes real stories about the real insides of people. And his name is Mr. Walter Besant. But he will insist upon treating his ghosts. He has published half a workshop full of them with levity. He makes his ghost seers talk familiarly and in some cases flirt outrageously with the phantoms. You may treat anything from a viceroy to a vernacular paper with levity, but you must behave reverently toward a ghost, and particularly an Indian one. There are, in this land, ghosts who take the form of fat, cold poppy corpses and hide in trees near the roadside till a traveler passes. Then they drop upon his neck and remain. There are also terrible ghosts of women who have died in childbed. These wander along the pathway at dusk or hide in the crops near a village and call seductively. But the answer to their call is death in this world and the next. Their feet are turned backwards that all sober men may recognize them. There are ghosts of little children who have been thrown into wells. These haunt well curbs and the fringes of jungles, and wail under the stars, or catch women by the wrist and beg to be taken up and carried. These and the corpse ghosts, however, are only vernacular articles and do not attack sahibs. No native ghost has yet been authentically reported to have frightened an Englishman. But many English ghosts have scared the life out of both white and black. Nearly every other station in India owns a ghost. There are said to be two at Simla, not counting the woman who blows the bellows at Siridak Bungalow in the old road. Mussoorie has a house haunted by a very lively thing, a white lady supposed to do night watchman round the house in Lahore. The house, he says, that one of her houses repeats on autumn evenings all the incidents of a horrible horse and precipice accident. Marie has a merry ghost, and now that she is swept by cholera, will have room for some sorrowful ones. There are officers' quarters in Mianmir, whose doors open without reason, and whose furniture is guaranteed to creak, not with the heat of June, but with the weight of invisibles, who come to lounge in the chairs. Peshawar possesses houses that none will willingly rent. And there is something, not fever, wrong with a big bungalow in Allahabad. The older provinces simply bristle with haunted houses and march phantom armies along their main thoroughfares. Some of the dak bungalows, or rest houses on the Grand Trunk Road, have handy little cemeteries in their compound, witnesses to the changes and chances of this mortal life,
in the days when men drove behind horses from Calcutta to the northwest. These bungalows are objectionable places to put up in. They are generally very old, always dirty. While the butler is as ancient as the bungalow, he either chatters senilely or falls into the long trances of age. In both moods, he is useless. If you get angry with him, he refers to some sahib dead and buried these 30 years, and says that when he was in that sahib's service, and not a butler in the province could touch him. Then he jabbers and bows and trembles and fidgets among the dishes, and you repent of your irritation. And these dock bungalows' ghosts are most likely to be found, and when found, they should be made a note of. Not long ago, it was my business to live in dock bungalows. I never inhabited the same house for 3 nights, running, and grew to be learned in the breed. I lived in government-built ones, with red brick walls and rail ceilings, an inventory of the furniture posted in every room, and an excited snake at the threshold to give welcome. I lived in converted ones, old houses officiating as dock bungalows, where nothing was in its proper place, and there wasn't even a fowl for dinner. I lived in second-hand palaces, where the wind blew through open-work marble tracery just as uncomfortably as through a broken pane. I lived in dock bungalows, where the last entry in the visitor's book was 15 months old, and where they slashed off the curry kid's head with a sword. It was my good luck to meet all sorts of men, from sober traveling missionaries and deserters flying from British regiments, to drunken loafers who threw whiskey bottles at all who pass, and my still greater good fortune just to escape a maternity case. Seeing that a fair proportion of the tragedy of our lives in India acted itself in dock bungalows, I wondered that I had met no ghosts. A ghost that would voluntarily hang about a dock bungalow would be mad, of course, but so many men have died mad in dock bungalows that there must be a fair percentage of lunatic ghosts. In due time, I found my ghost, or ghosts, rather, for there were two of them. Up till that hour, I had sympathized with Mr. Besant's method of handling them, as shown in the strange case of Mr. Lucraft and other stories. I am now in the opposition. We will call the bungalow Katmal Duck Bungalow. But the Katmals were the smallest part of the horror. A man with a sensitive hide has no right to sleep in dock bungalows. He should marry. Katmal Duck Bungalow was old and rotten and unrepaired. The floor was of worn brick. The walls were filthy and the windows were nearly black with grime. It stood on a bypath largely used by native sub-deputy assistants in the finance and forest departments, but real sahibs were rare. The butler, who was nearly bent double with old age, said so. When I arrived, there was a fitful, undecided rain on the face of the land, accompanied by a restless wind, and every gust made a noise like the rattling of dry bones in the stiff, toddy palms outside. The butler completely lost his head on my arrival. He had served a sahib once. Did I know that sahib? He gave me the name of a well-known man who had been buried for more than a quarter of a century, and showed me an ancient daguerreotype of that man in his prehistoric youth. I had seen a steel engraving of him at the head of a double volume of memoirs a month before, and I felt ancient beyond telling. The day shut in, and the butler went to get me food. He did not go through the pretense of calling it khana, man's victuals. He said ratub, and that means, among other things, grub, dog rations. There was no insult in his choice of the term. He had forgotten the other word, I suppose. While he was cutting up the dead bodies of animals, I settled myself down. After exploring the dock bungalow, there were 3 rooms beside my own, which was a corner kennel, each giving into the other through dingy white doors fastened with long iron bars. The bungalow was a very solid one, but the partition walls of the rooms were almost jerry-built in their flimsiness. Every step or bang of a trunk echoed from my room down the other 3, and every footfall came back tremulously from far walls. For this reason I shut the door. There were no lamps, only candles and long glass shades. An oil wick was set in the bathroom. For bleak, unadulterated misery, that duck bungalow was the worst of the many flats that I had ever set foot in. There was no fireplace, and the windows would not open, so brazier of charcoal would have been useless. The rain and the wind splashed and gurgled and moaned round the house, and the toddy palms rattled and roared. Half a dozen jackals went through the compound singing, and a hymn stood afar off and mocked them. A hyena would convince a Sadducee of the resurrection of the dead, the worst sort of dead. Then came the ratoub. A curious meal, half native and half English in composition, with the old man babbling behind my chair about dead and gone masters, and the wind-blown candles playing shadow bo-peep with the bed and the mosquito curtains. It was just the sort of dinner and evening to make a man think of every single one of his past sins, and of all the others that he intended to commit if he'd lived. Sleep, for several hundred reasons, was not easy. The lamp in the bathroom threw the most absurd shadows into the room, and the wind was beginning to talk nonsense. Just when the reasons were drowsy with blood-sucking, I heard the regular, "Let us take and heave him over," grunt of dooley-bearers in the compound. First one dooley came in, then a second, and then a third. I heard the palanquins dumped on the ground, and the shutter in front of my door shook. "That's someone trying to come in," I said. But no one spoke, and I persuaded myself that it was the gusty wind. The shutter of the room next to mine was attacked, flung back, and the inner door open. "That's some sub-deputy assistant," I said, "and he has brought his friends with him. Now they'll talk and spit and smoke for an hour." But there was no voices and no footsteps. No one was putting his luggage into the next room. The door shut, and I thanked Providence that I was to be left in peace. But I was curious to know where the Dooleys had gone. I got out of bed and looked into the darkness. There was never a sign of a Dooley. Just as I was getting into bed again, I heard in the room next the sound that no man in his senses can possibly mistake, the whir of a billiard ball down the length of slates when the striker is stringing for a break. No other sound is like it. A minute afterwards, there was another whir, and I got into bed. I was not frightened. Indeed, I was not. I was very curious to know what had become of the Dooleys. I jumped into bed for that reason. Next minute, I heard the double click of a cannon, and my hair sat up. It is a mistake to say that hair stands up. The skin of the head tightens, and you can feel a faint prickly bristling all over the scalp. That is the hair sitting up. There was a whir and a click, and both sounds could only have been made by one thing, a billiard ball. I argued the matter out at great length with myself, and the more I argued, the less probable it seemed that one bed, one table, and two chairs, all the furniture of the room next to mine, could so exactly duplicate the sounds of a game of billiards. After another cannon, a three-cushion one to judge by the whir, I argued no more. I had found my ghost and would have given worlds to have escaped from that dark bungalow. I listened, and with each listen the game grew clearer. There was whir on whir and click on click. Sometimes there was a double click and a whir and another click. Beyond any sort of doubt, people were playing billiards in the next room, and the next room was not big enough to hold a billiard table. Between the pauses of the wind, I heard the game go forward, stroke after stroke. I tried to believe that I could not hear voices, but that attempt was a failure. Do you know what fear is? Not ordinary fear of insult, injury, or death, but abject, quivering dread of something that you cannot see. Fear that dries the inside of the mouth and half of the throat. Fear that makes you sweat in the palms of the hands and gulp in order to keep the uvula at work. This is a fine fear, a great cowardice, and must be felt to be appreciated. The very improbability of billiards in a dark bungalow proved the reality of the thing. No man, drunk or sober, can imagine a game at billiards or invent a spitting crack of a screw cannon. A severe course of dock bungalows has this disadvantage. It brings infinite credulity. If a man said to a confirmed Dak bungalow haunter, "There is a corpse in the next room, and there's a mad girl in the next but one, and the woman and man on that camel have just eloped from a place 60 miles away," the bearer would not disbelieve because he would know that nothing is too wild, grotesque, or horrible to happen at a Dak bungalow. This credulity unfortunately extends to ghosts. A rational person, fresh from his own house, would have turned on his side and slept. I did not. So surely as I was given up as a bad carcass by the scores of things in the bed because the book of my blood was in my heart, so surely did I hear every stroke of a long game at billiards played in the echoing room behind the iron-barred door. My dominant fear was that the players might want a marker. It was an absurd fear because creatures who could play in the dark would be above such superfluities. I only know that that was my terror, and it was real. After a long, long while, the game stopped, and the door banged. I slept because I was dead tired. Otherwise, I would have preferred to have kept awake. Not for everything in Asia would I have dropped the door bar and peered into the dark of the next room. When the morning came, I considered that I had done well and wisely, and inquired for the means of departure. "By the way, butler," I said, "what were those three doolies doing in my compound in the night?" "There were no doolies," said he. I went into the next room, and the daylight streamed through the open door. I was immensely brave. I would, at that hour, have played black pool with the owner of the big black pool down below. "Has this place always been a dock bungalow?" I asked. "No," said the butler. 10 or 20 years ago, I would have forgotten how long it was a billiard room. How much? A billiard room for the sahibs who built the railway. I was servant then in the big house where all the railway sahibs lived, and I used to come across with the brandy wine. These three rooms were all one, and they held a big table on which the sahibs played every evening. But the sahibs are all dead now, and the railway runs, you say, nearly to Kabul. Do you remember anything about the sahibs? It is long ago, but I remember that one sahib, a fat man and always angry, was playing here one night, and he said to me, "Manga Khan, give me a drink," and I filled the glass, and he bent over the table to strike, and his head fell lower and lower, till it hit the table, and his spectacles came off, and when we, the sahibs and I myself, ran to lift him, he was dead. I helped to carry him out. Aha, he was a strong sahib. But he is dead, and I, old Manga Khan, am still living by your favor. That was more than enough. I had my ghost, a first-hand authenticated article. I would write to the Society for Psychic Research. I would paralyze the Empire with the news. But I would, first of all, put 80 miles of sound-assessed cropland between myself and that Dak bungalow before nightfall. The Society might send their regular agent to investigate later on. I went into my own room and prepared to pack, after noting down the facts of the case. As I smoked, I heard the game begin again, with a miss in bulk this time, for the whir was a short one. The door was open, and I could see into the room. Click, click, that was a cannon. I entered the room without fear, for there was sunlight within and a fresh breeze without. The unseen game was going on at a tremendous rate. And well it might, when a restless little rat was running to and fro inside the dingy ceiling cloth, and a piece of loose window sash was making 50 breaks off the window bolt as it shook in the breeze. Impossible to mistake the sound of billiard balls? Impossible to mistake the whir of a ball over the slate? But I was to be excused. Even when I shut my enlightened eyes, the sound was marvelously like that of a fast game. Entered angrily the faithful partner of my sorrows, Kadir Bash. "This bungalow is very bad and low caste. No wonder the presence was disturbed and is speckled. 3 sets of dooli bearers came to the bungalow late last night when I was sleeping outside and said that it was their custom to rest in the room set apart for the white man. What honor has the butler? They tried to enter, but I told them to go. No wonder, if these low people have been here, that the presence is sorely spotted. It is shame and the work of a dirty man. Kadir Bash did not say that he had taken from each gang 2 annas for rent in advance, and them, beyond my earshot, had beaten them with a big green umbrella whose use I could never before divine. But Kadir Bash has no notions of morality. There was an interview with the butler, but as he promptly lost his head, wrath gave place to pity, and pity led to a long conversation, in the course of which he put the fat engineer Sahib's tragic death in 3 separate stations, 2 of them 50 miles away. The 3rd shift was to Calcutta, and then the Sahib died while driving a dog cart. If I had encouraged him, the butler would have wandered all through Bengal with his corpse. I did not go away as soon as I intended. I stayed for the night, while the wind and the rat and the sash and the window bolt played a ding-dong 150 up. Then the wind ran out, and the billiard stopped, and I felt that I had ruined my 1 genuine ghost story. Had I only stopped at the proper time, I could have made nearly anything out of it. That was the bitterest thought of all.